ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that on one's 250th birthday, there should be a celebration. I'm Claire Nichols, and on The Book Show, we're raising our teacups to Jane Austen.
Why Austen? What is it about her?
Authors Colm Tobin, Karen Joy Fowler, and more will explore why, in 2025, the Austen effect is bigger than ever.
That's quite incredible.
Search for The Book Show and look for Dear Jane wherever you get your podcasts, or hear it now on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, I'm Tegan Taylor, and this is Life Matters, filling in today for Beverly Wang. The cliched Australian stereotype used to be a couple living in the suburbs with 2.4 children, but according to the last census, there were 2.6 million Aussie couples without children, and projections that couple-only families are set to increase. Not only that, there's been a cultural shift. People without children have a growing visibility. They're more likely to share and celebrate their lives. So today, let's join the party and celebrate the lives of people who don't have children. I want to talk about what fills your cup. Hobbies, goals, work, relationships, your adventures. Then in the next 40 minutes, it's time to ask Auntie. Today, our letter writer asks if he should make amends for his childhood behaviour. And with me is Tanya Williams, the author of A Child-Free, Happily Ever After, and Dr. Imogen Smith, clinical psychologist at the Ken Miller Institute. Welcome to you both. Tanya, I might start with you. Your big thing is travel. You're literally on holidays as we speak.
Yes. I'm very lucky that with not having kids, I don't have to worry about, but, you know, going away on school holidays and paying more and being in crowded spots. I can take off whenever I want. It's fantastic.
Where are you right now?
We are up in Woodgate Beach, which is up near Bundaberg. So every year we come for a pre-Christmas chill for a week or so, and it's absolute bliss. There's no one around. It's quiet. We walk on the beach. We drink. We read. It's just amazing.
Yeah, before it gets too tropical steamy up there, November's a good time of year. It's not even the first trip you've taken this year.
No, we've had a couple of weeks in the Maldives in March for our wedding anniversary. We've been to Vietnam for a little quick break as well in September. And then I've done a few other trips to, you know, Cairns and Newcastle and other sort of, you know, places in between. So I travel a fair bit.
That sounds beautiful. What else fills your cup?
Oh, my God, so many things. I'm so blessed to have the life that I have. Like, I know that I wouldn't have this life if I did have children, but I work on passion projects. Like, I've got, like, blogs. I've got podcasts that I do. I run a couple of businesses. You know, I've got so many different interests and things that I'm just like, I don't want to do this and I want to do this and I want to, like, there's just not enough time to be able to do everything. But I'm, you know, it's just so important for me as a woman to have lots of different interests and lots of different things that I'm passionate about that I want to share with the world. And, you know, being child-free allows me to do that in a way which I could not do if I did have children.
So Imogen, we've got different attitudes evolving around people who choose not to have kids. Sometimes they still face judgment. Listening to Tanya's story, I'm wondering if it maybe stems a bit from jealousy.
That's entirely possible. I think that attitudes are changing over time, as we can all probably acknowledge. And there's two aspects that I wanted to talk to here. One is that this is largely a gendered phenomena. So parenthood as compulsory is rather gendered. And so we have this long-held archetype that women are mothers, right? So historically, people assumed that women in particular should have children. And that, in fact, that they felt like there was a moral obligation to do so. If you think just back to 2004 with Peter Costello saying, have one for mum, one for dad, and one for the country. So that idea that womanhood equated with motherhood has been around for a while. And it's, you know, that's only 20 years ago. It's not really that old, is it? Mm. So the idea of not becoming a mother was unthinkable. And if you think about like the whole cat lady thing or spinsters, like we have all these tropes around that to support it. Words like selfish, immature, overly ambitious. It's you know, it's gross, it's awful, but these are all stereotypes that sort of are flippantly used. Some people even assume that if a woman doesn't have a child, that means she couldn't have had it. She was infertile. So there's a, you know, that people automatically default to that. You know, just one more example is Pope Francis in 2015, so only 10 years ago, saying that the denial of motherhood diminishes us. It takes away our humanity.
Yeah.
So I think when you've got all that in the background as a gendered landscape, I suppose, that's really tough to sort of be navigating through, as our callers will be for sure. But the discussions like this and having more and more examples in the media and role models for people to look to actually loosens the grip of that stigma. And I think we're seeing for the first time in history, and certainly in modern history, an era where women and men can be child-free, not childless, child-free. And famous child-free women include Oprah, Helen Mirren, Stevie Nicks, Betty White. I mean, what a role model, right? You know, Frida Kahlo, lots. Marilyn Monroe, they didn't have children. But the second aspect speaks to your point here, and that is that we have this idea that historically that children will make us happy, fulfilled. And in fact, the research did support that up until about the 1980s. But what we're seeing now is a trend both in the public discourse but also in the research showing that the emotional rewards of having children is actually outweighed by the emotional and financial costs associated with contemporary parenthood. Modern parenting is intensive, and I know you did a piece on this like a week ago, so you know what I mean. We actually now have a significant decline in well-being after the first child, like statistically speaking. So actually it's possible that parents who are in the trenches and really kind of having a hard time of it might look at someone who's having a wonderful life like Tanya and think, oh, but I want that. That sounds really good, but I don't have that option anymore. It's possible that there's some envy there for sure.
You mentioned intensive parenting. Yeah, you can listen back only a couple of days ago here on Life Matters. We talked about the fact that more and more kids are staying at home well past the age of 18 or even their early 20s.
Yeah.
So just factor that in, I suppose, into your decision making. Tanya, this idea of moral obligation, womanhood equating to motherhood, how has that landed for you across your life?
Oh, look, I mean, I've seen very different variations of it depending on my age at the time. So obviously it changes as you get older as well. So what Dr. Imogen said is right. As people, once you get to a certain point in particular, people just assume that you couldn't have children. And I obviously get that. But when I was younger, it was, oh, well, you'll change your mind when you get married. You'll change your mind when this happens. Like, oh, but you know, like, so you hear all that sort of old stereotype stuff. And the conversation certainly changes as you get older. But look, it's one of those things that is this expectation in society that this is what women do. You're supposed to find the man, get married, have children, retire, live happily ever after. Like, you know, there's that older generation is what they did. Like, and that's, they have this expectation of that, but that's what you do. Like, what else would you do? And of course, we've got this whole, you know, word selfish, which gets brought up, and it's like, how is it selfish to live your life the way you want to live your life? Because having children is a choice. Not having children is a choice. They are both choices. Neither is right or wrong. It's just what is right or wrong for you. And I think we need to have more conversations about that. And that's why, you know, I'm, you know, doing what I'm doing when I wrote the book and what I'm sharing on socials and the conversations that I'm having. It's around, I'm not anti-kids. I just don't want them myself. You know, and I think every woman should have that right to go, what is it that I want with my life, and be able to make that choice free of judgment and criticism from their family, from society, from the church, from media, from everybody else. You know, I think that's super important that as women, we are all able to do what we want in our own lives.
This is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking with Tanya Williams, author of A Child-Free, Happily Ever After, and Dr. Imogen Smith, who's a clinical psychologist at the Cairn Miller Institute. And we're talking about celebrating the joys of a child-free life today. Quite a few people have been texting in. Julia says, a very interesting topic. It should also be acknowledged that lots of couples are childless, not by choice. And while they can reap the benefits of child-free life, there can be shadows of sadness. At this time of year can be more challenging. Really good point, Julia. We're going to actually talk about that in a little bit. Alex in Melbourne says, I'm 34 and I don't have nor want children. I get fulfillment from various things like volunteering, building new skills like learning the piano, going to public talks and workshops. Alex says, I also have a dog who gives me so much love and doesn't need me to stand on a sports field sideline at 8:30 in the cold. I make sure I utilize my free time through altruism in my community because I know many parents don't have that time outside of their family. Imogen, we heard Tanya before, and you were mentioning it too, this idea of it very much being a gendered discussion here. Women get a lot of the focus when we're talking about not having kids. You've actually researched this gender split. What's it like for men?
Yeah, my research is on men, and I think they do have their own unique challenges. It's just not nearly as intense or widespread as it is for women because, well, for historical reasons and the patriarchy, really, to be concise. But for men, in the study that I conducted, they tended to be pretty blasé and flippant about any of that judgment or pressure. They said, yeah, sure, people expect me to have children. I just tell them I'm not. And that's the end of it, like with a bit of a shrug. Like there was no sort of internalizing of that stigma or kind of feeling kind of in knots about it. It was like, get stuffed, I'm not doing it, you know. And maybe that was just my sample. They were, you know, they were young men aged 28 to 34. Maybe they're just like on top of the world feeling themselves. It's unique for everyone, and I'm sure there are men who do struggle with this, but there's no denying that this is ultimately and always has been a gendered issue, this idea of creating life. You know, that in itself comes from women, right? That comes from people who are born female.
Mm. Another Tanya has called in. Tanya, what helped you make the decision not to have kids?
There were a lot of environmental considerations about the state of the world, but a lot of it, rather than the fabulous and amazing things I was going to achieve, which, you know, I've had a lot of freedom, but was also reduced stress. And I see a lot of parents having a really stressful time raising children in this kind of fast-paced society. And I know a lot of people whose children are struggling with ADHD and getting through the education system and just the challenges of this fast-paced world. And I just feel a lot easier not having that burden, actually.
Tanya, thanks so much for the call. That's a really interesting perspective. Imogen, what kind of things are people weighing when they're talking to you about considering to be child-free or choosing that for themselves?
There's so many reasons. I mean, you take one person who's considering being child-free and you've got five or six different reasons, and then so it's endless, the list, but I will tell you some of what the research tells us and what I'm hearing clinically. So I think the first reason might be because you can, quite simply. And what I mean by that is that one, the attitudes are changing, and two, that we have better access to high-quality long-term birth control. So that equals less unintended pregnancies. And, of course, I'm talking about the Australian context. I'm not talking about parts of the world who have less access to this technology. But since 1961, with the introduction of the contraceptive pill in Australia, we have seen a steady decline in birth rates. And that has just never there's been no uptick that has equaled pre 1960. The only uptick we've actually seen is COVID, when people were all home, which is another topic in itself, right? But we now have these long lasting birth controls, IUDs. We have lots of young men now having preemptive vasectomies. So they're sort of doing their part for this birth control. Then the other part, as I mentioned, was this evolving, changing discourse around gendered roles and around expectations of people. We are in a kind of era of more individualism. There's less stigma. There's more exposure to these kinds of conversations. There's more, like I said, media representation. Even like in my young life, I watched Seinfeld and Sex and the City, and that showed us that 30-somethings don't have to all be parents. We have women feeling free of those ideas that were very historical and deeply ingrained about what a woman needs to do and have an apron on and, you know, bring the dinner to the table at 5 p.m. or whatever. We're kind of free of those shackles. There's a whole new era in Australia, and it has been for decades, of women, you know, I guess it's a paradox here, but women can do it all. And I know that's constraining in itself, and I don't agree with that. But this idea, you know, in the 90s, we were all told you can have a job and be a mum too, or whatever you want. So Yeah. I guess getting back to the point here, the idea that being a mother is the hardest and most important job in the world, which is a really, really well-known kind of saying, it's been part of our cultural rhetoric for a really long time. And I think that is starting to loosen. I think people are starting to question that. We're leaning into the hardest bit, maybe. There's a lot of social media, a lot of Facebook, a lot of Instagram, whatever you like, where those kind of truths are being kind of put out there by people. People are feeling a bit more free to say what it's really like, what the raw, what it looks like, what the truth, the ugly truth of parenting, I suppose. And then others are being influenced by that and going, oh, that looks really like not what I want. Maybe I don't have to do that. So I think there's been a few reasons being talked about, but one of them is, and in my study, people said, oh, well, when I see these children climbing the walls at a cafe, I think, oh, thank goodness that's not me. There's also, of course, you know, women getting back into the workforce in a really significant way since, of course, I'm talking since the 1960s. We're now in an economy where you need two people in a household to earn money to survive and to pay your mortgage or your rent. I mean, that's nothing to be sneezed at. Mm. Not having children can be considered a pro-environmental behaviour. So that's something there's a bit of research about and there's a movement towards. And then, of course, I'm hearing actually, and I think I might have read this in Tanya's book, but some people feeling they don't feel parental, they're not drawn towards that. They don't feel like that's the kind of person that they are. They don't feel like they want to be a parent. A strong desire for autonomy. And the last one, which I haven't heard anyone mention yet, but I've read about in the research, is around being aware of your own mental health issues, illnesses, and trauma, and adverse childhood experiences, and maybe not wanting to replicate or kind of carry on the cycle. So maybe the parenting you received wasn't ideal for you, and then not wanting to kind of do that again with your children and thinking, I want to break the cycle and I don't want to carry this forward in history. So that's something I'm reading about as well.
It's interesting you mentioned the environmental side of things. On the text line, Meg says, I'm kid-free and fancy-free. I'm having a personal protest against capitalism. None of my offspring will be part of the army in the pursuit of land privatisation. That reason really makes people feel a bit repulsed, I think. One person has asked me about the happiness I'm denying. I suppose it's also about what type of unhappiness I'm also denying the land. Cynthia in Byron Bay, you decided in 1976 not to have kids. That was probably pretty unconventional at that time.
Yeah, hi, Tegan. Yeah, I grew up in a Catholic family. This will probably be quite a thing. My mum had seven kids and I was the oldest. And by the time I got to 16, I was like, oh, my God, my mum, my poor mum, she was like a slave. She just worked the whole time. And for me, it was nothing kind of outrageous. I just had this feeling, I'm not interested in this. I want a different life. I want to do the things that I want to do. And it was pretty much a rejection of that, but also Catholicism. Like I just had no interest in it. And I'm not like some cultural trendsetter. Like I didn't know at the time that it was going to be, you know, a thing. But for me internally, and I never said anything to anyone, I just thought, no, that's it, I'm not doing it. And luckily I managed to avoid getting married or having children, and I was on the pill for, you know, 20 years or so. And I sabotaged a lot of relationships where, I don't know, there was just something in me. I thought maybe if I get into this or I get married, then there's going to be pressure to have children. Not sure. But anyway, it worked out really well. I'm still really happy with that decision.
That's really interesting. Do you feel like you said you're the oldest of seven kids? By the time you were 16, you probably had a lifetime supply of parenting by being just the oldest daughter.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Cynthia, thanks so much for the call. Trish has also called in. Trish, you're in your 80s and a widow. You decided not to have kids. Do you want to talk to me about that?
Yeah. My name's Trish Richardson and I'm 80, not quite in my 80s.
Not in your 80s, just 80.
both Andy and I, I was married to Andy Lloyd-James, and we both felt it was a 36-hour-a-day job. And to do it well, a bit like teaching is a really, not everyone's suited to it. And we loved everybody else's children. None of us regretted it at any stage. And we never got told we were selfish. Oh, by the way, of course, We got married in 1975, so we're again way back when most people had children. And we did I say this? We never got told we were selfish, possibly because people weren't going to say it, except a lot of our dear friends said, who had children said, we really understand what you're saying. And not that we regret having them, but we can see very good reasons why you might not. And we just lead a really rich life and a wonderful marriage. And we travelled a lot, and we didn't do it because of our work, because I was a GP, and Andy, of course, as a lot of people listening would know, he was at the ABC and then head of television SBS, and then came back to the ABC as head of a whole lot of other things. And it wasn't because of work. It was because we just knew it was a really, really important job that you needed to be very good at. So that's really my story.
Trish, thank you so much for that. That idea of really honouring the job of parenthood and going, I don't think I need to take that on in addition to everything else, or I want to be able to do it justice. Tanya, is that ever something that crossed your mind, or were you just always like, no, thank you?
Look, certainly you see how hard parenting is. Like, you know, when you're, you know, I saw what sacrifices my mother made, and, you know, she was the homemaker. Dad went to work. She would ferry us around to netball training and practice and school sports and, you know, all the stuff. And she didn't really ever have much time for herself. So you sort of see that, and I think unconsciously you take all that in and go, yeah. And look, I was very much a child of the 80s. So I grew up with Murphy Brown and Dynasty and Dallas, and saw all these really strong female role models going, wow, look at this life that they have. They have these amazing careers and all these great material possessions, and they're happy and they're powerful and they're, you know, and I was just like, that's what I want. So I looked at the two, I guess, and went, love my mum to death. But I don't want her life, because I can see how much sacrifice is involved, how much it actually takes to raise, you know, I'm the oldest of two, to raise kids. It is hard. And the problem is, and we're seeing more of the real stuff come out now, I think, but for many years, people just put motherhood on a pedestal and went, oh, it's the best job in the world, and look at my cute little kids. And, you know, they painted a picture on social media that was very different from reality and what actually happens in day-to-day life. And I think we need to call that stuff out as well and go, well, it's all good to have these nice moments, but there's all this hard stuff that happens as well. So for me, I was just like, I don't want that. You know, I've got dogs. They're a big enough responsibility. You know, I've still got responsibilities. I've run a household. I run businesses. There's a lot on my plate. It's just a different type of responsibility, which I'm happy to take on. But, yeah, certainly from a kid's perspective. And as you said before, kids are staying around forever now. So they're not a responsibility till 18. They're a responsibility forever. And if they're not moving out of home until they're 28 or something, like, that's a huge undertaking. When do you get a break? When do you get to breathe and start doing the things that you want to do, you know, as a woman, as a parent? So I think, yeah, you need to take, it's the biggest decision you'll make in your whole entire life, and you need to take it seriously.
On the text line, someone who says they want to remain anonymous says, I have adult children. It's hard. It's still hard. While parenting does bring joy and fulfillment, I can't help think that joy and fulfillment is outweighed by the emotional and other impacts, which are sometimes brutal. Thank you so much for your honesty. We were talking about the very gendered nature of this discussion before, but we have our first male caller. Paul, you say you've never wanted kids. Can you talk me through that?
I'm late 50s now. It's never been a part of my desire or my plans in life. Mm. Ever since I was as young as I can possibly remember, I've always wanted to be childless. So there you go.
And you wanted to make a point on the idea of sort of preemptive vasectomies that Imogen mentioned before.
Yeah, so I was talking, that's sort of why I'm ringing in. Well, the main reason I'm ringing in, or prompted the call, I was obviously many, many years ago tried to get a vasectomy and didn't have kids. And I fought with multiple doctors for months and just could not get a vasectomy. And I tried doctors in my local area in Sydney. I went everywhere. And several of them said to me, we won't consider you for a vasectomy until you have children. So I said to one of the doctors, that's a bit like saying, look, there's a seatbelt in the car, but don't use it until you have an accident. And I'm surprised that, I'm shocked actually that you're able to get that now, because in my time, and I'm going back several years, obviously several decades, it was impossible. I think it's good now that they're giving people a choice to do what they want with their own body.
That is really interesting, Paul. Thank you so much for the call. On the text line, one person says, loving this conversation. We're in the middle of deciding whether to do our fourth round of IVF, and it's hard to decide when we enjoy our lives now and don't want to keep pulling ourselves between each life option. We get so much joy from our garden, our friends, and travel. I love hearing how others manage that this difficult choice, and I don't believe being a mum is the only identity I want. On a similar note, Jasmine says, my partner and I were unable to have children. We looked briefly into artificial insemination. I was clucky for all of 3 days after my sister had a baby, so we happily got on with our lives. We lived and worked in about 5 countries, have travelled to over 50. We're now retired. Yes, no kids to look after us in our older age, but there's no guarantee children would step up. Could be living a long way away or just not able. Jasmine says, we've had a fantastic life. Well, Imogen, people come to you because you're a psychologist, they come to you in crisis. Can you talk me through these stories of people who maybe haven't known since they were little that they didn't want kids? They're really kind of straddling two potential futures for themselves.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, just to say that people can come and see a psychologist anytime. We don't need to be in crisis. And of course, I welcome people just navigating life. These discussions are really important to have, and what a great way to have it in confidentiality with a person who has no vested interest in your personal decisions that will just walk through that with you. I do have these conversations a lot. I have them with, teenagers all the way through early 20s, people in their 30s, people on IVF journeys, people who have lost babies, people who, are really sort of struggling with this fork in the road, I guess, because it's really significant, isn't it? Not to make too light a comparison here, but it's always intrigued me that we have this discourse around, oh, are you sure you want to make that commitment to that pet? It's a lifelong choice. That's a forever home, this kind of language. And I don't know that we have that same conversation about children often enough. People do kind of go into that lightly sometimes, or perhaps accidentally sometimes. It is a conversation that is worth having and sort of unpacking and weighing up the pros and cons for yourself and thinking about what you want for your future and what's meaningful to you. And it isn't for everyone, and that's okay. That's part of what we unpack with people is where are those ideas coming from? When you think about that idea that you just told me, that thought, where did you first hear that? And they might say, oh, my mom or, my grandma. I'm like, okay, well, is it yours? Mm-hmm. Is it theirs? How much do you believe that to be true? Do you want that to be your story? So really just sort of drilling down into where do our ideas come from, because they'll pop into our head. And what's the first thing I say to people is thoughts are not facts. Just because you thought it or just because someone said it doesn't mean it's true. So let's work out what's true for you and let's work out what you want for your life, and then we go from there.
You're listening to Life Matters here on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Dr. Imogen Smith, who's a clinical psychologist at the Cairn Miller Institute, and Tanya Williams, who's the author of A Child-Free, Happily Ever After, and acknowledging that this has been a pretty heterosexual chat we've been having so far today. On the text line, someone says it would be interesting to take this conversation to the societal level and talk about heteronormativity and the way it tries to push us into reproducing. This text says, as a gay man, I'm genuinely surprised by the apparent desire for some sort of heteronormative ideal. And Lorraine's called in. Lorraine, your sexuality influenced your decision not to have children.
Yes, that's true. Look, I'm 72 now and I was very working class, and my sexuality came up. I guess that ended up in a divorce. Mm. These days, well, straight divorce, maybe not so much now. And I guess in a way, and I also, at that time, some women, the challenges to them being able to keep their children in court was that they weren't fit mothers because they were lesbians. And I suppose that influenced me, and I just automatically, at that point in my life, around about 28 years of age, thought, that's it. I don't, there's no chance of me ever having children anymore because I'm a lesbian. And look, thank God today that's not the case. But yeah, it was. It just my mind just said, well, that's the end of it, and that was societal, and you know, in some ways, in horrible ways, you're a dirty lesbian. And so it influenced me that yeah, that was the end of children.
Good Lord, Lorraine, what a terrible time to be growing up. I wonder whether you regretted. Did you have to mourn the fact that you weren't going to be a mum, or were you okay with that?
I suppose it's one of those things. I think, you know, at some level it's a bit of a fantasy in your mind. Oh, I would have loved to have had children, and gee, I wonder what sort of a mother I would have been. So, you know, it's at that fantasy level because I perceived, I think, pretty much because of my class status. So I wonder whether for more middle-class women at that point in their lives of my age may have kind of brushed aside, you know, that sort of stigmatism and stuff. It might have been a bit easier, I don't know. But I guess in a fantasy level, yeah, I probably would have liked to have been, you know, a mum. Yeah, probably. Although my parents married really late. I think Dad was 46 and Mum was 40. And that, I'm not, no suspicions on age now. But I guess in that time I ended up, I was my parents' child, but I ended up, because they were, you know, that age when I was growing up, I ended up being their parents. So in some sort of perhaps strange way, I ended up happened to be their parent. Yeah. So in some strange way, I guess I ended up being a parent, but I guess I lost my parents, but I lost my children as well, if you can kind of grasp that concept as well.
Lorraine, it's such an insight you've given. Thank you so much for sharing your story. Anita in Melbourne's also called in. Anita, you're a child psychologist, but you don't have kids. Do people find this an interesting choice of jobs?
Well, everybody that knows me is not surprised because of how much I love children and how good I get on with children. And when I did start making it clear that I didn't want children of my own, you know, to my family and friends, there were some friends who just couldn't believe it. Oh, but you're just so good with kids. You would just be such a good mom and so forth. And growing up, when I chose my career and such, it was like, I think that if I had my own kids, I'd just be a crazy person in the sense of like, I'd just be too obsessed with everything they were up to or doing and this and that. And I mean, anybody who's studied anything about child development, you'd be exposed to Piaget. He was one of like the first researchers, a scientist, and he had six kids of his own. And he just, you know, watched them and took notes about every single thing they did and as they grew up and so forth. I said, I'd be like that, you know, I don't know if it's a good idea for me to have kids. But the other point I really wanted to make was when I was studying and around other mostly women who were also, you know, studying to become child psychologists, when we got to about 30, everyone that was still single was so concerned about finding a partner so that they could start having kids. It was getting, you know, I'm 30 already. And so there was a real tangible thing that was happening for them that was like this biological clock ticking. And when we would come together and talk about it, you know, in groups, you know, I'd just say to these guys, you know, my friends, I don't know what you're talking about. I don't feel that. I don't feel that. There's nothing compelling me that's like, oh my gosh. So I was aware that some women physically, emotionally, I don't know what it is because it wasn't there for me, but there is this biological clock ticking thing that is very internally felt. That was really interesting. There was one other thing I'll say about that, it's similar to one of your other callers that I heard. You know, you make relationship choices around, you know, does getting into this relationship mean that I might have to make a different kind of decision or be pressured and such? So I didn't, I'm married now, but I was 40 when I got married. Both my husband and I are again, like love children. And what that means is we've actually spent a lot of time, maybe more than typical aunties and uncles, you know, with our siblings' children and with other children around us and so forth. So it certainly hasn't been like a lacking in terms of, you know, having kids in your life.
Kids in your life, but not your own biological children. Tanya, your husband's not joining us on the call today, but what went into the discussions you guys had in your early relationship around your desire to not have kids?
Yeah, look, it's such an important conversation to have, and it always amazes me when people actually don't have this conversation before they commit to a relationship. But look, we got together quite young, so I was only 19, because we've been married 30 years now, and we got married when I was 23. But when we got engaged, around 21, I think it was, I said to him, and he'd already knew that I'd already said, like, I don't want to have kids. And, you know, at that age, people don't take that seriously a lot of time. They think, oh, you're too young to know, you know. But I always knew that I didn't want to have children. And then when we got engaged, I said to him, if you want to have children, then let's not do this, because, like, I'm not going to change my mind for you, your family, or anybody else. I know what I want, and you need to be okay with that. And he was totally on board. He said, I'm marrying you. I love you. He said, we'll have, you know, nieces and nephews, and we've got other friends, kids and stuff around us. So, you know, he was perfectly fine with that. And look, in saying that, I've checked in over the years, of course, at different times to say, hey, you know, like, are you still happy with everything? And he has been. And let's just say he loves his lifestyle. So I sort of said, can you imagine right now you'd be going and picking up kids from soccer and doing this and not sitting here, you know, having a drink by the pool and doing all this sort of stuff. So, you know, he does like his lifestyle. And, you know, we do have, you know, kids around us. You know, we've got nieces and nephews and friends, kids and so forth. So it's not like we're never around children. But we just like to, you know, do that, socialize, whatever, and come home to our own space within our own sort of place and do our own thing. So it is such a huge conversation that you have to have, because so often I hear stories of people going, well, I just assumed you wanted them, or I just assumed you didn't want them. And then they get into a relationship, they're married, and then they go, oh, hang on, you didn't want kids, or you did want kids, and I just assumed you wanted the same thing as me. You're like, you can't do that and not have that conversation. So it is so important that people are really open about what it is they want for their lives before they have that commitment, because it will make or break it at some point, and that just leads to heartbreak.
We are running pretty close to time, but Imogen, can you give us just a couple of tips on how to have that kind of conversation in a constructive way?
Yeah, I'm absolutely glad you asked. This is something I don't get to talk to people about much, because the person who's in the room is the one who needs this support. I think probably it's best to think of it as something fairly unemotional, if you can, to just sort of, it's another choice that the person's making about their own future and their own life and their own identity. It's maybe as, you know, ordinary as what hair color they have. Like, if that helps you to sort of just bring the emotion out of it. And when someone says to you, a friend or a loved one, I don't think I'm going to have children, my response would be, okay, did you want to talk about that anymore? Or is that it? So then, you know, opening up that line of conversation if they want to, but if they want that just to be a statement and let that drop, then let it go. Would you like to talk about it? No, thanks, not yet, I'm not ready. Okay, no worries, let me know when you are, if you ever do want to talk about it. If they do, then engage in that conversation by all means, but we don't need to maybe insert our own opinions and heartfelt feelings. So let's say I have children and my friend says to me, I don't want to have children. That's not a slight on me. Yeah. That's not something I need to take personally. I just be with them in that moment. Okay, what's that about? Like, what's, you know, what are you gonna, what's behind that? Or, you know, whatever, you can ask a curious question by all means, but don't make it about you. Like, oh, my children have brought me so much joy, you should definitely do it. That's not their story, that's your story. So I think that's probably the main advice I have, is see if you could approach that conversation without it necessarily being yours, your conversation, and without too much emotion, if possible. Children bring up emotion. This is the thing, isn't it? And they stir something in us. It's almost evolutionary. So it is very challenging to take a step back and talk about it really objectively. But if you can, that's probably the best approach.
Neutrality as a way of approaching those conversations. Tanya, Imogen, thank you both so much for joining me today. Tanya Williams, the author of A Child-Free, Happily Ever After, and Dr. Imogen Smith, clinical psychologist at the Cairn Miller Institute. Jill on the text line basically saying what Imogen just said beautifully. We're all committed to the lives we choose. Please respect and accept the decisions of others without criticizing. It's simple. Some people become parents, some have difficulties having children, and some people choose not to have them. Well, stick with me because coming up next on Life Matters here on ABC Radio National, it's time to ask Auntie about the case of the remorseful former bully.
They prayed, they preached, they rebelled. From God Forbid, this is the Religious Rebels podcast, the stories of people who defied empires and sometimes paid with their lives. From Joan of Arc's battlefield visions to Malcolm X's final revelation, we tell the stories of those who defied faith and remade it. Religious Rebels, the original disruptors. Search for God Forbid ABC wherever you get your podcasts or on the ABC Listen app.
When your unkind childhood behaviour still weighs on your conscience years after you've said farewell to school, it's time to ask Auntie. Today, we're talking about early school days. Our letter writer is in a reflective mood about the way he treated a classmate many years ago. And to help work out the best course of action, we have two aunties poised to offer their insights. James Finlay, ABC broadcaster and journalist, and Monica Ducks, a writer, commentator and columnist. James, Monica, aunties, welcome.
Oh, great Hello. To be here.
Auntie Monica, what was your school experience like?
Look, I don't think you could ask that question to anyone without them saying that they didn't leave school feeling unscathed.
I was very scathed.
We were all in some way scathed. I met up with a friend in my early 20s. I hadn't seen her for years since high school, and we bumped into each other. I'd moved cities, and we were chatting about school and looking back, and I said, oh, you know, some kids were so mean and there were all these really awful experiences. And she stopped and she looked at me and she said, Monica, that was all of us. That was all of us. So, yeah, look, generally it was okay. I do sometimes look back and think, how did I behave? Like I will remember many moments where I felt kids were mean to me, but maybe I was also mean to other kids.
Yeah, Monica, you're not special.
James. Yeah, I'm not special. I'm a cliche. I'm a cliche.
What about you, James?
Yeah, look, I did enjoy school, but there was certainly plenty of difficult moments throughout primary school, high school. But I went to a small regional school. Like, by the time we got to years 11 and 12, there were only like 60 of us or something. Mm. So the kind of nastiness kind of died down by then because there were so few of us. I think when there are so few, then you kind of know each other a little bit more intimately. But look, yeah, it wasn't a walk through the park.
Well, it sounds like you're both perfectly qualified to answer this question today, which has come from Matt. He says, I'm in my 30s and recently I've been thinking about someone I bullied in primary school and feeling a lot of guilt about how I treated them. I was bullied myself, but as so often happens, I took my anger out on others, especially with one kid. Let's call him Pete. He was quite reserved and didn't have many friends. I would go out of my way to call him names. And one time when he was walking in front of me, I tripped him on the concrete and he fell and grazed his knees. Even at the time, I knew it was wrong and I felt bad about what I'd done, but I didn't help him. The things I did to him usually got a laugh from my classmates, and I'm embarrassed to admit it made me feel good sometimes. Auntie, some real transparency coming through from Matt. Monica, how do you feel about his treatment of Pete?
Oh, look, that is really awful to hear. I guess what sticks up for me in defence, or not so much defence, but to make Matt maybe feel a bit better is he's in primary school. And I reckon primary school is a bit unhinged for a lot of kids, you know. They're like, you know, small children are like wild animals and sometimes they're biters. And I think it's really hard when they're that age and kids do behave badly. I think once you get to high school and people start behaving badly, they're more adults, and that's a different proposition. But no, that's abominable. I'm so sorry this happened to Pete, and I'm curious as to why Matt's reflecting on it now.
Yeah, I was going to call you a bully apologist, but you made a very nifty save at the end there, Monica. James, what do you reckon? What do you think? Why do you think Matt's looking back to his primary school years so nostalgically right now?
Yeah, it is. I'm also curious to know why now is the time. But look, it is interesting looking back at these things. I don't know, maybe there's some kind of event that's popped up, or, you know, social media may have like popped up this person from the past into the feeds. Who knows? But look, I do understand the reflection of this kind of behaviour, because, well, I think some of us do think about the way that we acted in the past. But look, I've got to agree with Monica, like, you're in primary school. Let's like take the foot off the brakes a bit and like give yourself a bit of leeway.
Okay. All right. Well, so Matt's letter continues. I've been grappling with this guilt. I've been thinking about whether I should reach out to Pete and try to make amends, but I don't know if it's a good idea or how he would respond. We don't have anything to do with each other as adults, but we have mutual friends. Monica, if one of those meanies from your primary school reached out to you now, would that be welcome to you, or would it bring up those feelings?
It could be. I think the problem is that when you're that young, how you remember these things, and obviously Matt remembers it really vividly. I would be curious as to how Pete remembers this and how he's processed it. So, look, what's jumping out for me here with Matt is, why is he seeking absolution? Is he feeling bad and he's seeking absolution? Should he be thinking, and he's saying, I'm not sure whether I should reach out to Pete, but it's like, is this going to be a sincere, unconditional apology, or does he just want to feel a little bit better about poor behaviour?
Oh, you think it's like self-serving?
Look, understandably, he wants absolution. We all do. I would love, you know, people to accept an apology from me, but sometimes you have to think, but is it in the best interest of this person? And he is grappling with that, and he does need to figure that one out.
So, I mean, he's told us he's in his 30s, so we've got a couple of decades between primary school and now. James, what do you reckon? Is it long enough? Is it too long?
No, I don't think it's ever too late for an apology. And I think, reaching out of the blue might be a tad bizarre. I don't know. If you're going to if you're going to an event or someone's wedding or a school reunion, you're going to run into them, then I think that would be an opportunity for an apology. But I've had people who treated me badly in primary school and high school apologize to me.
Oh, you have?
Yeah. In the past, like, it's happened a couple of times, or a few times over the past 10 years. And it's been a couple of decades since I'd left school. And I've welcomed it. Like, even if it is just for them to, you know, make themselves feel better, then that's fine. But at least, like, I know that then they've reflected and they realized that they were, you know, not a great person, and that they've turned that around. There have been a couple of times where I've been surprised when someone said, oh, I'm so sorry that I treated you this way. I'm like, honestly, I didn't realize you were doing that.
I think that's part of the problem, isn't it? Because there's an element where someone could be apologizing to you and you're like, oh, I didn't know there was a problem. And then that opens up a whole lot of can of worms.
Oh, look, it didn't open a can of worms for me. I was just like, all right, well, look, I'm glad that you've reflected on that and we can continue. But like, I'm now one of really close with a guy that was unpleasant to me at times during high school. And I'm one of the only people he talks to from high school now. So, you know, you never know where these things might go, Tegan.
That is so interesting. And it's funny that you mentioned the reunion, James, because it's almost like you've been sneaking a peek at the rest of Matt's letter.
No, my school reunion was on the weekend, which is why
seriously?
It's fresh in my mind.
How many, can I ask, how many years?
Yeah, 20.
20 years from?
Yeah, 20 year reunion from a high school, from year 12.
Yikes. Wow. Happy
anniversary. But I couldn't go. I was away.
Oh.
But I've heard all the stories.
Well, Matt's coming up to his 20 year primary school reunion. So Matt says, I keep thinking I'm going to see Pete there, and it may be strange if this is unresolved, or is that the place to resolve it? Is it best to leave the past to rest, or should we seek out the people we've wronged and apologise? 20-year primary school reunion. Is this a thing? It must be.
It's not a thing for in our town because we all just went to the same high school.
Yeah, right. Oh, you again. Yeah. What about you, Monica? Have you ever been to a primary school reunion?
I've never been to a school reunion and I don't live in the same city, but yeah, I sort of fear them. I thought about it, but I'm a bit older than you, James, so I've got an extra decade.
Well, had a lot of opportunities for reunions and you still haven't gone.
Maybe it's all those apologies I still need to make.
Well, okay, yeah, exactly. Is it cool, like, to come up to a reunion? Is it a good time to apologise or is it make it even more awkward, Monica?
No. See, that's, to me, I would say my one certain piece of advice to Matt would be don't do it at the reunion because that could, you know, it's ambushing Pete. It could embarrass him. It could make him feel awkward. Who knows? Pete might have spent the last 20 years pumping iron at the local gym and it could get ugly. you don't want to ambush someone. I mean, I think he should, if he wants to approach him, it seems it's an appropriate thing to do. He should approach him, you know, via an email, keep it very simple, keep it very open-ended. Don't put himself in it. I think this idea that, you know, Matt trying to excuse himself is not appropriate. Just saying, look, I think I behaved badly. I really want to apologise. Are you open to talking about it?
What do you reckon, James?
Yeah, I'm on the other side of this. Like, as someone who was approached at my 10-year high school reunion and had people apologise, it was like I think don't corner him, don't corner poor Pete, and bring back memories. But I think a casual, like if you're, I think it would be more awkward if you're both in the same room and you don't talk at all. I think that would be more awkward than, because then you're avoiding it. Obviously there's a bit of shame going on there, but I think if there's a casual approach at the reunion, I think that would be a good move. My thoughts.
On the text line, Max, not Matt, says he could try writing a letter but make it clear he doesn't expect anything in return. I too would like to know what prompted reflection. Yeah, Matt, can you write the letter and then let us know? what kind of...
CC.
Yeah, please do.
BCC.
A brief final word from James, mostly just because I'm interested. You said you're now mates with someone who wasn't very nice to you at high school. How did you rekindle? I don't even know what the right word is. How did you find friendship even though it hadn't been a nice start?
I think, so we were kind of living in around the same area at the time and I don't know how it popped up, but I think I was like, oh, I'm living in the area now. Like, did you want to catch up or something? And then caught up a couple of times. And then that's when he was like, look, I do want to apologize. And I was like, look, it's really fine. Like everyone was kind of an a-hole in high school, you know, like, you know, you're going through puberty, like you're trying to work out who you are. You can't, you know, manage your hormones and your moods and whatever. Like I wouldn't worry so much about it. Like everyone had their moment.
Yeah. Teenagers known for being level-headed and kind to everyone they encounter.
Totally.
We do have to leave it there, James. Monica, thank you both so much for joining me today. James Finlay is a ABC broadcaster and journalist. Monica Ducks, writer, commentator and columnist. And thank you to Matt. I hope that our auntie's insights gave you a little bit of guidance today. If you want to share a story, a dilemma with us, lifematters@abc.net.au is the email address. Chuck Ask Auntie in the subject line. Well, that is almost it for Life Matters. Coming to you all this week from Jagera and Turrbal Land, Beverly Wang will be back with you again next Friday. Thank you, as always, to the whole Life Matters team, Jordan Bissell, Grace Pashley, Max Rowley, Kate Ubergang, Beck Zajac, and executive producer Lachlan McIntosh. And I'll be back with you again on Monday. We're going to be talking about how more of us are working multiple jobs. What does that mean for the rest of our lives? Plus, what are your rights when it comes to working over Christmas? Don't forget, you can get in touch with me, the whole Life Matters team, anytime. Our email address is lifematters@abc.net.au. I'll catch you on Monday.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.